veto comment for any technological purpose. I was just handed one of these, as you may have been. I don't know if this is a class project masquerading as a site, or a site masquerading as a class project. Does anyone want to claim ownership of it? It's your project. And any way this can harbor sue you? Sort of go ahead and make our statement. And what did the letter say?
From us to them.
No, I don't know.
The letter from us to them just said, we started this new website, and this is its purpose. And as a courtesy, we're just informing you so there's no confusion about our, you know, legitimate critical criticism purposes. And we haven't heard back yet. We put the letter on Saturday, so.
They have a sophisticated website.
Hey, I wrote HTML. I think it helps.
Well, I think we're helping to tell. It's all over 8 degrees. Now, you're right, so there's sort of trenchant criticisms here. Oh. Just enough to get me in trouble. Well, I'll tell you, it's always so hard for me to get the general counsel's office to call me back, and now, maybe they will.
Well, the other thing is that we think we're on good grounds as far as trademark. So we looked at trademark infringement, APCA, and the UDRP. And this is basically our hypothetical slash real scenario that we think should fare well under those possible causes of action.
Gotcha. But you might as well have some high-priced legal talent to put the right here the final part of your bid before you apply, giving you reasons of the letter. Well, fascinating. Keep us posted, please. I wonder if it would be friendlier or something like Harvard Law School rocks.
But then we wouldn't be okay under free speech product risks. Like, you know, you sort of have to have socks there to legally make it clear to avoid likelihood of confusion. I mean, vulgar though
it
is.
That's a little section of the anti-cyber squatting consumer protection.
It kind of is.
Yeah. Well, they say the law sucks sometimes, they mean it. Great, well, it'll be interesting to track that. It's actually a nice lead-in to our situation with Intel being deep. But before we get into that, I thought I would just share a couple things that actually happened yesterday while we were talking about spam. I have no idea who Absinthe is, so maybe Phil does. Hang on. Oh, www.bytes.com/news/0/158550. There we are. So, as their lawyer was not a stick of the switch, but here talking to us yesterday, the real-time black hole list was losing on a temporary restraining order, which is, of course, only the opening salvo of litigation wars. In Denver, Federal Court in Denver issued a temporary restraining order against Maps after the anti-spam group publicly labeled 24/7 Media, subsidiary Exactus, a prime distributor of unsolicited email. So they now have a restraining order ordering them to remove Exactus's 150 email outgoing servers from the real-time black hole list. Presumably they will obey that restraining order and then continue to fight in court. And Paul can actually say this is exactly what he wanted. He's, you know, embracing litigation, and we'll see what happens. That actually just happened at 4:59 p.m. We were literally in class at least when Brian Krebs posted his letter of not when the decision came down. I don't know if anybody wants to find the actual memorandum in order, if any there was, that embodies CRO online. Yeah.
I actually asked him yesterday, because this was a few days ago. So I noticed this a few days ago, and I asked the guy about this yesterday, and he actually wasn't overly happy about it. I asked him about it because it seems to suggest that in fact he's losing money based on what was happening, what the anti-spam group were doing. And he said there was a gag order, so he couldn't really talk about it, but he didn't seem overly happy that they lost. So
I'm shocked to hear that, but yes. All right, so it'd be interesting to want to try to find the memorandum of order. Indeed, there are so many computers here, and since I don't run real-time comment submission system today, we sort of let that fade out a little bit. Why don't you try to get that up and running? I want to make sure our computers are being put to good use. I somehow caught a reflection of the bulb of the projector over there. Several intense games of solitaire were happening yesterday, and I hate to carry around a ruler and map puzzles or something like that. That appears to be out of favor. But I do deserve the right to single you out and subject you to some form of ridicule, or perhaps post a message to the HarvardLawSchoolSucks.org site in the event that temptation gets the better of you. I can't say if I were sitting in front of the computer that I would do the same thing, but I would hope that someone would help tie my hands to the mast to prevent me from doing it, so I'm just trying to do you a favor and tighten the noose, I'm sorry, the bonds of the rope just a little bit on that mast. That's also so needed to the feedback on those from yesterday. Thank you for filling those out. I've had a chance to go through them. People, again, generally happy, generally particularly happy about the change in workload that company responsible last set of feedback on those. Nobody dared to say, make it even lighter. Although some nervousness, I guess it's typical for this time of year, about rating and such. So I won't engage in a lengthy soliloquy on the subject, but just remind you that the FAQ posted on the site has some information about how the voice is graded, including the allocation of effort on the paper, the rotisserie, and real live class participation. That includes any time you participate in class, so I encourage you to do it in what class there is remaining. There's also understandably some sense about the fact that there's been no actual grading and returning of rotisserie answers. I regret that I never one person and simply can't do it in a useful way during the course of the term. It's too bad. It'd be nice to do it. The investment of time put in on this sort of thing really went into paper abstracts, which was a fairly Herculean task to go through and get a sense of what each person was, what each group was working on and get some critique on that. So that's where the energy went. Now, and this may not be totally known, but you can view the reactions to what you did when the question got framed. I mean, the idea behind rotisserie conceptually is that it's not so much something graded at the center as the sole way of figuring out what people thought of it, but it's actually rotating from the person. So you can actually go online and read what people have been replying to on your answer. In fact, you can do all the answers. I don't know if people knew that you could do that, but John can actually at some point demo how to, oh, I think it's right here. This is it. That's something else. Well, that's the remote comment submission system. Okay. So he can end up showing how to apply on the site and actually get to where there is some reaction to what you're doing from fellow students. And this is a law firm. It might well be circulating something from fellow associates and hoping to use the pieces commonly. That should be the spirit in which this is taking place here. Let's see, anything else on the feedback on those? Nothing else that jumped out by way of criticism worthy of addressing, but I'm just glad people are generally happy. I guess with that, we are prepared to actually get into substance as soon as Gallon's finished demoing how to get into the archive. Any questions about the demos?
Nothing? Just log in, as you normally would to the first word, and then scroll down to the bottom of the page. Second to the left, like the registry archives.
Has
a list of all the questions that were asked, and you can click on any one of them.
This is also a way of finding out. Some people have asked, how many have I skipped? And here's where you can find out without having to do a manual recount by commissioners voting. You can just check the machine yourself, and eventually when Elon got a lot of our energy replies, there it is. You can then do is actually the helpful control F to find within the page. So this page is pretty huge, which may be why it took so long to do it. But you can scroll down. If you can find, you can punch in your name or your alias there, and it'll just jump right down to anything that has your name to do with it. So exactly. I guess it's part of my name, but yeah, there you go. So I vote for my skips for this question. So
you can check all of them in just that you're obviously about three skips before there's any adverse effect on your grade, and there were some people have asked if you skip the initial question, then you obviously don't get a crank, because that counts as two separate skips. We've just agreed that that is one skip if you skip a question, so.
Great. All right, then. So let's hop over to substance then for today. I saw one other thing online, which was another reaction to the real-time black hole list. This from a guy that runs the site known as livepair.com. It's titled Spiritual Warfare, the Enemy is Attacking. This is God versus Satan. And God told me when he gave me the vision for this internet industry, it's going to be a major battle since the internet has basically been Satan's domain to a large extent. Still is. The night before Halloween, somebody tried to sabotage our site and mailing list and added approximately 100 people who were known witches, warlocks, anti-Christians, and anti-spam advocates to start receiving our daily devotional message. Needless to say, these people were incensed when they started to receive the devotional. Rather than just following the simple delete message at the beginning, they began, especially the anti-spam advocates, a very concise and calculated campaign to eliminate livepair.com from the internet. Unknown to us, there's a group called Max in San Francisco. That's what's on that whole list. They've appointed themselves the policemen of the internet, and since their mission is to rid the internet of spam, has been able to strong-arm all of the major ISPs in the country to utilize their self-proclaimed list of spam sites. These major ISPs then shut off the mail. There is no due process, no procedure. Max is judge and jury and sole decision maker without ever contacting the parties involved. On Thursday at 11:30 Eastern Time, LivePair was shut off by our ISP because they had been blacklisted by the Max organization. So he talks about kicking the devil's butt, and then says, as a result, he couldn't get his important devotional out. That important devotional talked about our need of 700 people to give an immediate one-time gift of $100 to help us cover the shortfall that occurred. And pray hard, see if you are one of the 700 God has called to stand with me during this now most critical time. You can either make a gift by credit card on a secure server at our website or by check or money order. And this signed Bill Kelly. As you can see, there is definitely a religious component to some of the arguments about spam. Let me tell you about a case that you didn't have in the meeting that may start framing today's stuff, which is CompuServe cyber promotions. There's a guy named Sanford Wallace, also known in some centers and some circles as Spamford Wallace. Sanford Wallace, we couldn't ask Central Casting for a better kind of jaunty villain if you see Stan as evil, which I understand not everyone does. And Sanford Wallace had a company called Cyber Promotions that just sent out tons and tons of spam around the clock. And CompuServe was one of the, still is I suppose, internet service providers that also provides email to approximately 2 million people. 2 million people have CompuServe email boxes. And wholly apart from the real-time black hole list, CompuServe simply started to lose mail that they realized was coming from Sanford Wallace. They just turned it away at the first step. And Sanford Wallace actually was not happy with this. He was the defendant, though. CompuServe, after finding it, was even taking an effort to turn the mail away, sued Sanford Wallace for trespass on the CompuServe servers. And a federal judge in Ohio agreed with CompuServe that these emails were trespass. It's a private server. The email was coming in. Apparently, Sanford Wallace was so efficient sending out emails that most of the email CompuServe received in a day was coming from Sanford Wallace as spam, rather than the typical email just going from friends and neighbors and cookie recipes around the viruses. And as a result, it was deemed trespass. It was told not to. He had gotten around some of the technical means that CompuServe had built to try to block him, and CompuServe sued him and won. And I'm just wondering, is there anybody that would be willing to take up the cause on behalf of Sam Wallace? Is the world a better place with an injunction against him in trespass? Perhaps somebody from our panel would care to share a view on it. Josh Singer?
Yes, I'm the free speech advocate here, and I'm actually known as Josh Spammer in these circles. And I feel that, well, there are a couple of different things which concern me about this. Number one, you might note the argument that Bill McSwain pointed out, in which he talked about once an injunction is made by a court, is that not a state action, which therefore limits free speech? And as a state action, does that not fall into play as strict scrutiny of the First Amendment?
So help us with this. Presume that some of us haven't taken the time off. Give us a one-minute nutshell on what you're talking about.
So the one-minute nutshell, as I understand it from my reminiscences of common law as well as my readings were, was that in terms of the First Amendment and the right to speak, it's only guaranteed within the context of government insofar as, one second.
Maybe sleeping in the sun would be nice to wake us up a little bit.
So, the First Amendment acts as a shield against state non-private conduct. Private actors are generally free to censor speech without impunity, but if the state censors speech, then there are a number of, you have to have strict, there's a fairly strict bar in terms of, depending on what kind of censorship the state, any sort of content-based regulations, or say I'm going to, you know, listen to this speech or not listen to that speech within a public space, there's a strict scrutiny attached to that.
So let's cut to the chase. You say that CompuServe is a state actor?
Well, CompuServe is not a state actor. However, once it uses the courts to actually protect it, in terms of to actually uphold this sort of trespass theory, it's now the courts that are saying, no, you may not trespass to stay at the white. You can't send this spam. And once the courts say that, then the courts are a state actor. And that triggers this state action principle, which therefore triggers strict scrutiny of the First Amendment.
So if a religious proselytizer comes to my door on my property, lets himself into the house because I happen to have left the door open, and makes himself at home on my couch until I come down with my bathrobe in the morning. He greets me, says he'd like to discuss some spiritual stuff with me, wonders if I'm one of the 700 that maybe call me with money. And I say, get out. And then I call the cops to remove him. The cops' removal of him is subject to strict scrutiny by your theory?
I guess that's a very difficult hypo. I'm sure there's
is a difficult hypo.
Are
we just sweating bullets over this?
But it's not difficult hypo. Obviously, it's not subject to strict scrutiny because it's short property. It's a difficult hypo given the box that I've made myself into.
Yeah.
At this point, though, I refer back to the.
A lopsided concession is very effective in litigation. You notice it's very good. It's very powerful. So I'm curious what you're going to say next.
At this point, however, I move to my second line of argument, which is that. I've actually just spent a week in Florida, so I'm familiar with sort of moving around the second lines of argument. Anyway, which is actually, I talk about public forums, and I say, now wait a second, doesn't CompuServe create in this sort of area in the area it creates, doesn't CompuServe try to, what are the exact words? One second. As Edward J. Naughton would say, CompuServe tries to create a marketplace of ideas. It's a place, it holds itself out as a global marketplace of ideas. And as such, doesn't CompuServe sort of create a place that is much like a public park, or perhaps a very large shopping center, like the Pruneyard Shopping Center in California? Doesn't it create a space in which it is asking for dialogue, and as such, becoming a public space, doesn't it therefore also become a realm in which we will have similar strict scrutiny? I don't know what's going on. I speak, and here I speak to Marsh, I speak to Pruneyard, I speak even to Huggins. Hutchins, sorry.
Huggins, too.
retail hasn't basically struck down in the particular shopping center was talking about, that it said, okay, the shopping center is private property. It said that the word set up at characteristics that a public space possesses to be considered a public forum, and they are that a property must have as a principal purpose the free exchange of ideas, evidenced by a long-standing historical practice of free speech, and that this public forum is created when the property is intentionally open for the public discourse. And I say to the public, sir, don't we have just such a type of public forum in which you must let all actors speak, and if you do have some sort of content-based regulation of speech, that regulation should be shown strict scrutiny.
And do you think that it would survive strict scrutiny? The order against Sanford Wallace to stop hitting Comedy Center with millions of emails.
You said, does this in any way interfere with Comedy Center being able to create a public space for others?
Well, they have affidavits on file that says it's certainly making it more expensive. They've got to put on more and more server capacity to handle the crap that's coming from Sanford Wallace.
As I recall from common law, strict scrutiny is a very high bar. That said, I forget exactly what the standard is, but I think it's something along the lines of if you make reasonable effort, if there's a substantial, you probably remember it better than I do. Which reminds me of the strict scrutiny. You are a professor, though. And I'm a mere lowly student at this. I really am not.
This is not an effective course.
Well, anyway, I'm working a very strict standard. However, if there is a substantial government interest or something of the like, and this is the only way that substantial government interest can be protected, somebody out there must have been found more recently.
For
a lateral
pass,
yeah.
I have an
interesting
argument
for
common law,
but
I think one more argument that you actually wanted to say was that what distinguishes Jonathan's example from our example is that in Jonathan's case, we're dealing with one property, one private property, one forum, whereas in our case, we have two forums. That is, in your scenario, I'm actually physically entering your private property, whereas in this case, and I think this is why this analogy is probably not 100% appropriate, because there's difference between cyberspace and your space, that I'm not actually entering. The question is, am I being really trespassed on these channels or not? And I would argue that I'm not, because I'm actually not entering this property the way I would be.
The channels are untouched by the hands. So, that is another line of argument. That doesn't rely on the Constitution at all. That just relies on common law argument about trespass. What is a trespass? You may remember, there's probably that case about molecules, whether smells count as trespass or a nuisance. Well, I suppose you could say this is a nuisance too, and then go into the common law nuisance analysis. Yeah.
But don't you also always have to sort of weigh the interests? I mean, obviously, and I think if, what we have to talk about is the consequences this would have on the internet and on free speech on the internet, and what the internet is actually about and what's right. What's the free flow of information?
Yeah. Let me take a poll before we put some more cases on the table so we've got more places to work with. I'm just curious, how many in gut think that Sanford ought to lose the trespass claim? Sanford ought to lose against the officer. And how many think Sanford should win, should not be found by the trespass claim? All right, that's pretty much the breakdown I was expecting. Let's just get another case on the table and let's talk about detail. I'm wondering if John Snyder can tell us about where are you at, John?
Intel involved a disgruntled employee, a former employee, who protested Intel's hiring and employment practices, managed to get a hold of all the email addresses, or majority of the email addresses of Intel workers, and send them emails that were critical to Intel. And Intel tried to block, we got around the block. Ultimately, Intel succeeded in giving a injunction against this person from sending email.
So it sounds sort of like a concert case, right?
In many respects, yes. However, the speech at issue was different. It was not commercial speech, which generally has a lower degree of protection. It was political, or however you might want to characterize it, non-commercial speech, which in general have a higher degree of protection than others.
So, talk about Satan, really, fighting the forces of darkness. Right there. So, here's his website, the faceintel.com website, with the motto that the price of justice is eternal publicity. I think it was about the price of justice being eternal vigilance. And, quotations from people who hate Intel contain a 43-year-old mother of 2 young children. Intel sounds like the last place on the planet, balance or security. I've got some untestimonials and all sorts of bad things about Intel, lying and cheating, things like that. But he didn't just talk to this site. You're saying he sent emails to former colleagues of his at Intel. This guy used to work at Intel, now he's working full time on his website. How many emails did he send? How many batches do you know?
3,000.
30,000,
a lot.
And how many batches, how often are these newsletters that you send? 6 newsletters over what period? I think it's about 2 years. So he sent out 6 installments of his newsletter over a 2-year period. Not nearly as frenetic, certainly, as Sanford Wallace's stuff. And with no argument made seriously, from what we can tell by Intel, that this was actually burdening their servers. It wasn't as if it was slowing them down. These emails were but drops in the bucket for what they normally get. Does that seem somehow relevant to a decision when, of course, inevitably goes to court and using cyber promotions as a precedent, Intel says, stop this guy from trespassing? Is that, to your mind, effective outcome?
I think it, insofar as that it's a trespass case, if you accept the fact that his actions, just unwanted email onto the Intel system, were trespass, then it doesn't matter. If the evangelist went into your living room to really cause you that much inconvenience, or if he just went onto the corner of your front lawn, he's still trespassing. And if you want, you can go to court and they can get off the corner of your lawn.
But let's push that a little bit, because we are talking virtually about trespass. So I think you're right. Somebody that just sits in the corner of your lawn is trespassing. That's a binary condition that they're trespassing or they're not. But here, you could imagine some hair-splitting judge saying that the trespass in cyber promotions was the burden, was the harm, the cognizable harm to the server. And if it were possible to send an email without any material harm to the server, could that be deemed a non-trespass or not?
To me, just maybe getting a little bit away from your question, I think this talk about trespass is not the issue. As you said, it was a drop in the bucket. Put a figure on what it cost Intel to receive these messages, maybe $20. If the court just said, okay, fine, it cost you $20. A meeting, you pay $20 each email and you continue email. I don't think that would be how much they tell for me.
So I don't think true. Although rarely is for a cash machine.
Well,
so long as you're prepared to pay the damages of purposely cash, so that baseball is not really fun.
What I'm saying though is that the argument that their moral right to not trespass upon or to not have damage to their effect. I think not the issue. The issue is they don't want their cash logins of workers being exposed to people who dissent. In other words, they want to control what people see.
And should they have a right to do that?
tough question. If I was thinking about some alternative hypotheticals, I think about Fenway Park. Let's say someone doesn't like the way that a game or that the team is running business or doing the seizing plan or whatever. If somebody stands right outside of Fenway Park and casts out leaflets on the street and saying, oppose the Boston Red Sox, this is a captive audience of customers that the Red Sox themselves have brought to the desert money and bringing. And you can see how the Red Sox would not want these people to be exposed to these leaflets. Yet if they try to stop someone, I don't think there's any question that they're going to be thrown right out of court.
At least when they say right outside, they're contemplating this public property.
On the sidewalk, not on their land. So when you get away from trespass and talk about protecting either workers, the same analysis would be true for workers leaving work. There's no right of an employer to stop a dissenter from contacting their workers and criticizing each other.
So let's just take another quick sense of the rule here. In a similarly styled trespass action by Intel against Ken Hamidi, how many think Ken Hamidi should lose, should be found in a trespass, and with no defense? Not only, you know, how many people think Ken should win? So either Bill McSwain is very persuasive, or perhaps you're very persuasive. So somebody who has different views between the two cases, which is basically most of you, let me hear what looks it for you, compared to John's view. Anybody else who voted the first way? Yeah, Felix.
I guess, to me, the sort of amount of it really does matter. What would make me a little uncomfortable is this idea that, you know, even though no one would actually prosecute me for it, if I just went and, you know, found a friend who I had never seen before, who I hadn't seen in a long time, I just found their email address and I sent them a piece of email, but that doesn't help me trespass if that person then later decided that, no, they didn't really want to hear from me. You know, because I'm using, however small, I'm using some tiny, tiny amount of resources in order to send this email to this person. So if it's trespass when you send any kind of email that turns out to be unwanted, you know, no matter what the quantity of it, then it feels like it's, I don't know, maybe an argument ad disaster or something. So that, to me, the quantity of it really does matter.
And is there no decision for you? If there were some way of knowing, if the email address for your friend Jane Smith were, don't email me unless I've emailed you at janesmith.com, would it seem any different to you or not?
And therefore I know ahead of time that I shouldn't.
Yeah, but there's some sense that you weren't welcome.
So the issue is, if I email that person anyway, should I then be liable?
Yeah.
Sure. I'd be willing to go with that. I mean, because then the person has sort of, I don't know, stated their intentions ahead of time.
But it sounds like then what you had previously said, the rule premised on the decree, a rule premised on, is it a little bit of mail or a lot of mail you sent, which lets you catch Sandra Wallace but let Ken go, might be a rule premised on one bite of the apple, just like welcome yesterday. So that you get your chance to assume you're welcome, but if you're told no, you've got to stop.
Right, the issue in this case is who gets to tell them to stop, right? I mean, so the funny thing about this, right, is that you've got this sort of, I don't know, it takes back to some of the, you know, companies reading email issued before, where you have this company-provided resources which sort of generally accepted that you're going to use for some other purposes as well. So I wouldn't be at all uncomfortable with the idea that, you know, if Ken continued to send newsletters to people who had told him to stop, that he should be held liable for that. But on the other hand, having the company as a whole make that decision for the employees doesn't necessarily seem like the right action.
Gotcha.
Yeah?
I think more significant than the amount is the type of speech, especially if you're asking for a gut reaction. That's what my gut tells me. I don't know that I can explain it in legal analysis or anything, but we're talking commercial speech that nobody wants or cares about or thinks is very important versus the sort of things that we think about the First Amendment protecting.
And that's what differs, what cyber motions does from like.
Yeah.
If Ken, so we have to look at the content of his message, at least to decide whether it's commercial speech or whether it's stuff we care about.
We can maybe do that.
With disturbers, yeah.
Well, I mean, that, the problem I have with that is now you're making content-based distinctions on speech, which is the whole thing we argue against. Not us, you know, in favor of the First Amendment, we argue against these sort of content-based distinctions on speech. And I don't think that that's necessarily, I think this whole Puritan idea of putting some speech in a higher place than others, I'm sort of against that, I would say.
Although we have the doctrinal pyramid that appears to be just that.
Yeah.
Your question was, first, do you think it's trespass? And I didn't think it was. And then you said, well, do you think you should win? And I said, but I don't think you should win, not on the trespass grounds, but I'm not sure exactly what the claim would be, but some sort of corporate misappropriation, because he took, you know, assuming he took these 30,000, less than 30,000 emails from, you know, while he was working there, that's not public disseminated information. And then, you know, what kind of harm is that? He sent, you know, six of these of 180,000 emails, and people, you know, employees are coming time. It's different than standing outside to work and talking to people as they're leaving their job, you know, contacting them while they're at work, while they're getting paid, and, you know, they spend a minute per email on average, and some people just delete it, but some people might do the whole thing. That'd be some 1,000 hours, and there's a real harm there.
Would that work for just regular junk mail, or sending junk mail to people with work addresses? The corporation could go after the junk mail, or for wasting the time of the employees?
I guess it depends on how they got the emails in the first place. They got the emails because the people who were at work were kind of surfing, and then, you know, so their email got on some site, and they bought it that way. I don't think that's the issue, but if you're actually getting the emails from inside.
So you focus on how Ken knew how to address this work.
Right. If it was kind of an opt-in where, you know, maybe the initial email went out to everybody and then it said, you know, if you don't reply to me, you will not get an update on this. And then so everyone was voluntary, I think someone mentioned this before. You know, if they voluntarily wanted to get these emails and some personal emails are allowed, then I don't think there would be any action.
Yeah.
Yeah, just on the viability of the transmission channels, I wonder if there's a telecommunication line, if Bing had just sat there every day and called people, just on, you know, 000, you know, the three-digit beginning of the exchange, and just called for information and said, this is what I want to tell, and gave it a recent update, and they called text person, and that was 000, and all the way up to, you know, that'll take about a month, and then the next thing's got to be better. Would that be even conceivable as trespass?
What's your own sense?
I think that it's a poor idea to make electronic signals going into a server a trespass. And the analogy would be that electronic signals carry over a wire, either an optical wire or, yeah, a copper wire, telephone, to call that trespass to chattels. And just on that derivation, we get that.
Yeah. You can certainly try to pass a federal statute targeted exactly this behavior, as in the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, designed to say, the cows in the telemarketing industry, they're allowed to call you once. If you then tell them never to call you again, and they call you again, you can bring a private action against them in the common state court for $500 every time they continue to call you. Of course, there's some evidentiary issues and how you prove you told them the first time, et cetera, et cetera. But that has withstood First Amendment attack on the kinds of doctrinal twists and turns expected. But there's no state action problem. It's clearly something that has to withstand the First Amendment, even if it's targeted commercial speech. And it does, it wins. But it gets its day in court under the First Amendment because it's just a federal law under something to challenge. Yeah?
I'm curious what the legal definition of private property is. I wonder if one could make the argument that because no one really owns the internet, that as soon as you get on the internet, basically it's the filters and the firewalls that are the walls that surround your property. And without those in place, you're essentially, you know, it's like having the floor plan of your house open to anybody. There's no locks, there's no doors. county, there are no land property rights in the internet, so it's not as if you own the land you're on, so that it would be the responsibility of the ISP to erect filters and firewalls to keep people out. To use the analogy that they were talking about, you know, it's as if Ken is standing on a public freeway shouting his message, and, you know, I think Intel is entitled to wear earplugs if they like, but I don't think that they can take Ken, who's out of the public, unregulated space, the internet, and prevent him from saying what he's saying. It seems to me that they should, the responsibility is on them to filter out objectionable material.
And is that what you figure Intel is asking to have happen by going to court?
My impression was that they wanted the media to cease and desist, they wanted to stop sending messages to the Intel email servers, am I correct?
What Intel was asking for? What's the remedy? What's the order under which Ken Weeney labors right now? What's the restriction?
I believe he may not email or under penalty of contempt.
He can't walk up to any email program and type in a message directed to anybody at Intel.com.
I'm not sure.
Yes.
No more unsolicited emails in Intel.
Unsolicited defined as that email which Intel Inc. doesn't want.
Unsolicited not to block. But that's what the order says.
And Intel has already said they don't want it. So if he walks up to a server anywhere in the world, a computer, and types in Hotmail to the sales and support at Intel.com and hits send, he is potentially in contempt of court.
He probably doesn't use their products.
Intel, not inside. Yeah. Well, there we go. Comments too. Let's get there and then do a little comment.
This is going back to the partial speech debate. I mean, I took first amendment, so I'm kind of rusty on it, but I know it does get a lot less protection than other stuff. And one thing that I think might help this problem is even to get any protection at all, the commercial speech has to concern lawful activity and not be misleading. And a lot of those emails I think are misleading, like $1 million to the Bahamas.
You don't think you can?
Maybe not. Maybe it's something to look into. But, and also those like sex with 17-year-old girls and stuff emails, those are probably illegal too. So that's not legal activity. That would be like barely legal. Or I think they're kind of sketchy. So I think if you attack them from that problem, they don't get any protection at all. But it's commercial. It's maybe false or at least misleading. And so,
so that's why cyber promotions.
Yes, so I think that's,
you're saying that's why.
That's a distinction. That's another distinction, yeah.
Right. And this is from, Brian gives us some help on strict scrutiny. Has a sort of compelling governmental objective that is necessary to as narrow as possible to achieve that objective. That sounds right to me. And then Chris Babbitt says that ISPs have no value absent their position on the public network known as the internet. When they buy a parts of the network, they set the position they own these railroads. And there was a common carrier doctrine to deal with railroads and freight. And so now it seems like we should have common carrier regulations to ISPs, which says that ISPs have to carry stuff without regard to what's inside the boxcar, the boxcar being a packet. And then Claire says, what if information.com starts saying on a newsletter, those insurance are paying off, going to downsize severity on associates who never accept, who had ever accessed the center, is no. They sent it to the associates working there, so I wouldn't want to get it, and I wouldn't want my firm to be able to stop it. Well, there might well be a disconnect between the interests of the individual Intel employees and the interests of Intel. Clearly, those who haven't told Ken to stop either just hate it and haven't gone to reply, or they don't mind getting it. And Intel is trying to speak for them because, after all, we suppose Intel owns the physical box that is the Intel.com mail server. Now, I suppose as a matter of corporate workplace policy, they could try to penalize their own workers for using the machines or using their email accounts in certain ways. But it still gets back to the question of what can they ask of Ken as a collective entity? And if somehow they're pointing to a receipt showing they own the server, dispositive in establishing that they are the ones upon whom the trespass happens, when in fact, it's just their employees who
who are burdened by having to look at this email is burdened at all and have a chance to opt out. I mean, does that, does it seem like it's the employee who's in a position to say you're trespassing on my time or my life? Or is it Intel because they own the box? Yeah, right.
Well, I think the purposes of the corporate email account, while somebody's at work, Intel owns the box and the employee. So what the employee does in the employee's own time or the employee's own email account is not Intel's business. While the employee is at Intel using Intel's computer network, sitting at their Intel desk, supposedly being paid to do Intel work, then Intel should be able to say, you know, you can't do this, and by the way, I own the box, I own the employee, I don't want this garbage, take it away.
Yeah, Sean?
I'm an employee of Intel, and I don't like that one bit. The Intel works for me kind of like a dog, I'm pretty darn hard, I don't agree with this meeting, but it's a place where we all work hard, and part of our lives occur in this place. I have a relationship with friends and family who are distant over my email, my work email. Part of my life is here. They can't own part of my life.
But if Intel told you that Intel's email, because of legal reasons, it's stipulated further than that, because of legal reasons, we demand of our employees that they only use Intel.com email services for official business, would you really have some claim against them?
Well, ask me if I have a claim is different from asking if I like it. I don't know that I have a claim against it to say you have to give me the right to use this for non-business purposes. I do know that as a practical matter, I don't think that's the way it works in many workplaces. I think in most workplaces, people combine the two together.
I was just going to say that it's funny to be mad about Intel owning you in your workplace. That doesn't distinguish it from cyber promotion. So you still have a problem where in cyber promotion, you still can have those email account holders. Maybe they hold the account, but they definitely don't hold the line from which they're getting their email. And so maybe it's hard to, we're all going on really instinct, so it's hard to distinguish why CompuServe is able to just shut it off without asking. I'm not sure that they ask their email people. They all just probably assume that no one wants to answer. We all assume that no one wants to answer. But from our discussion yesterday, maybe there's some few people in the world who want that opt-in.
Who, according to the judge in the cyber promotions case, can simply choose a spam-friendly ISP?
Right. But I mean, you're still talking about what if CompuServe, you're still talking about restricting that same speech, and I just don't see how you can go down that track and distinguish it.
Yeah, John.
One distinction I would offer is that the relationship between the ISP and the person is a lot different than the relationship between the employer and the individual. You can change ISPs quite easily, and you can say that there's a marketplace for ISPs if you want to stand for them, and you go to that, no big deal. I think the argument is harder to make with respect to an employer because it's a big thing. It's a lot harder to change jobs. And if you say that, I think that's a place where a rule has to be made one way or the other, whether there is a right of an employer who's granted an email service to read political or non-commercial email on the company's pay. I don't think you can say, well, there's companies that do, companies that don't, any more than you can say that, well, there's a marketplace for sexual harassment firms, you know, and some allow it, some don't, if you don't like your firm, because if it harasses you sexually, then go to the one that doesn't.
Yeah. Well, there are plenty of people that might say that was a good thing. You're right. You did. Yeah. Anyway. So,
the definition of trespassing channels, and instrumental to the channel, that either results in damage to the channel itself or to the owner of the channel. In cyber promotions, there was the damage to the channel itself, the net itself. And into the person talking, there was damage to the owner of the channel, to the internet, by losing workers, by losing workers' time. So I don't see why you can't apply on this other option.
So if the trespass is the burden to the server rather than the infringement of the right not to have a message. It's not assertively defined as a mere sending a message, but rather some collateral harm that comes from the processing of the message. Now we see how we might distinguish silent motions from the meeting, because the meeting hasn't heard the Intel server the way that the office was heard the conversation.
Yeah, but he did damage the older contender. Isn't it there? He also.
Ah, because the content of his mail is damaging the other thing, because it's getting way around, it's making the content of this.
Trespass and trespass can be done either by damaging the channel itself, or the older contender. So, yeah, people.
Those are that indistinguishable.
What?
Those are that indistinguishable, those kinds of harms that are done.
Yeah, they're indistinct, but they're both included under trespass and trespass.
Yeah. Yeah,
the issue of Trump is on that, and I think this is going to be a certain argument, so get ready. It seems as if, I'm going to jump ahead into the free speech argument. Well, what you've got there is you're looking at the harm of the speech, you're looking at the effect the speech has on the listener. And it seems like that harm is indistinct from whether the chat was used or entered or broken or pulled into possession of the owner. Now, the only issue is the speech content of that message. So I find that a lot more troubling than just my search slower or I can't access it.
So they might both be harms, but they're different kind of harms, perhaps wording in different weightings or something, whether the trespass analysis or somehow figuring out what the trigger of the person might be.
Right.
Let's put one more case on the table as we go forward. This is the Marsh v. Alabama. Okay, so Dan, you want to take a crack at that?
This is a case in which a Jehovah's Witness was trying to pass out religious flyers on the sidewalk in a company town. And
what's a company town?
A company owns the town.
A company owns the town.
A company owns the town.
The company owns the entire town. So there's a company in a church, and it's like Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. PBS just owns the box office. There was no way you can run and not be on territory with that PBS.
Right. Basically, the court said that basically the state of authorities can say, well, the owner of the family is the one who's got the property, and the court said that they couldn't because it's not. As against property owners' rights, the rights of freedom of press,
Mrs. Marsh is sitting there handing out her literature on Main Street of Chickasaw. Main Street of Chickasaw looks like Main Street of a dusty, suburban, working class town. But there's a subtle legal difference, which is that the town of Chickasaw doesn't exist as a public corporation, rather it is just an artifact of the Gulf Shipbuilding Company. So the workers come home, Main Street is owned by the Gulf Shipbuilding Company too, and she's there and she's told, you've got to leave. We don't want trespassers like you on our private property. So now, how is this different? Is somebody being in my living room and be asking that person to leave? Private property, right?
Because the company basically stepped into the state by informing us important public function while your rooms, just your room, you have opened it up to the public.
So now it has to labor under the restrictions of the Bill of Rights because it happens to own the street as well as the rules.
Right. Well, just because we kind of the company is becoming the state, it's informing itself.
And as a result, what should happen?
Therefore, the company can't restrict the insurance.
But more exactly, I guess it means that Mrs. Marsh cannot be convicted of trespass as a result, because the First Amendment test applies, she passes the test, she can't be convicted of trespass. Yeah, Jeremy.
Yeah, I think this brings up the question of what you were saying about if someone outside the Boston Press Office, outside the very part of the street, think we hate the Boston Press Office, think that that's okay if you want to come back. Intel has 3,000 employees, does that make it private? But if it has 300,000 employees, does that make it public and available because of people sending emails? Is it a numerical thing or is it something else?
So Marshby, Alabama is a personally agreed opinion. It's written in there on the getting forward processor, so they actually have sweat after the word. So it doesn't get into that really. And from what we know, what year was Marshby, Alabama? '46. So this was a while ago, by any record. And there haven't been a lot of cases updating it since. So it's not clear. All we know is that Marsh falls on one side of the line, to the extent it's still good law. And that probably Fenway Park is going to fall on the other. In fact, you may have heard vague discussion of the shopping mall cases. The shopping mall cases typically hold the shopping malls fall on the Fenway Park side of the line, and you're not allowed to hang out in shopping malls. There should be literature. They are allowed to escort you to the door, and if you refuse to go, hire a rental cop or a real cop, and eventually go after you for trespass, despite what Marsh says the shopping malls aren't coming to towns. Yeah, Felix.
My understanding was that it had to do with how much the purpose of the location we were talking about was for people to contact and essentially communicate with each other. So the distinction was made, you know, you can't do this in a bank where basically you're there just to, you know, just to transact business with the bank. You can't do this in the medical center where you're trying to get medical services. Presumably, you know, Fenway Park starts to get iffy, but presumably you're there to watch the ball game, right? And then, I don't know, the shopping mall starts to get even more iffy, but when you've gotten to the point where you're actually talking about a street that's, you know, that happens to be owned by a company, then sort of generally the purpose of the street, especially in this case of a main street, is for people to congregate and to communicate with each other, as opposed to, you know, talking about a street that's just part of a highway and just is what people are happy to be using to get from one place to another.
Yeah. The line that we had traditionally drawn, which seems to have a benefit of being clear, not perfect, is the line between public owned property and private owned property. That's usually a reliable guide as to whether, when you stand there and do something obstreperous, somebody can successfully dislodge you. If you're on public property, there's a lot of protections for what you do, a public park, a public sidewalk, you name it. In fact, there's a lot of skepticism even about a public entity trying to create a separate space where you're allowed to go. No, don't stand in front of the abortion clinic. Here we have a special roller rink that we've rented for you to skate around it with your sign several miles away, and that's how you can exercise your public right of protest. No, it gets shaved down to within how many yards of the clinic you could be, not is there adequate fairgrounds somewhere else. You get a right of proximity even to that which you choose to protest, but still again, rights argued over public property. The minute you step on the private property, you're going to have a hard time arguing for your right to be there, unless it seems we get again to the Marsh case, where, yeah, it seems like so much has been subsumed by the private, it is in essence public, including spaces for which we typically think of as public functions. Tell you.
I think the Marsh case is a different case like that. Are maybe helpful here in understanding what is happening. And I think that the Intel case is interesting because it combines the internet, which really functions as a somewhat public and somewhat private space, and the workplace, which is increasingly becoming dominant for people spend their time. And Intel, I'm sure, is high on the list of places where people spend more of their time at work than anywhere else. And it's really more time at work than in public spaces. A lot of workplaces now have places where you eat, places where you can buy things, places where you go to the gym. Actually spend your public time at work.
Some people have been seen entering law firms and they're leaving.
That's what I hear.
Yeah.
You kind of tell me it's not true, but so the internet is very functions for communication on the internet in a place where that is now the dominant public space for these people. And it seems like that is edging us towards a Marsh type situation where, yes, it's privately owned and ISP is you know, box owned by Intel, but the reality is being used for the public types of things like shopping, interacting with people, and
you know, clean the dunes that you would once do on a corner in town, not a corner street. And so we're not going to find a way to eke out some sort of public right to those spaces. We're going to lose value of many of them.
So on Open Code Day, and also a little bit on Microsoft Day, I literally raised the prospect that the internet as we know it didn't have to unfold this way. It could have been a big AOL. The internet as we know it could have just been AOL, more people signing on to this local fun thing would be signing on to a big AOL, and like AT&T for phones. And if AOL started doing spam prevention on the Cyber Promotions case, when they were the only game in town, would that somehow make it some more Marshall-like?
Clearly, you have, I mean, part of the, I think, an appealing argument on the other side is that you can shop, right? You can use the market to choose and opt in or out of either spam or intel. I think that those are less true if we need to combine them. And the reality is that it's not a perfect marketplace with perfect information. In fact, it's a very imperfect marketplace with nowhere near perfect information. Most of the people had this communication from how many have been excluded, they wouldn't even know if they were getting it.
So one dimension is this monopoly thing. If it were one actor basically controlling all of us, we can't shop elsewhere, that somehow triggers stuff that might not otherwise be triggered. But even if we imagine the preservation of choice, if there were, for example, a provider of medical services who strategically positioned the clinic in the middle of a preserve owned by one party, sympathetic to the cause of the clinic, so that you had no gauntlet of protesters to walk through or near because it was in the center of this huge space for which private property could be asserted. In that case, even outside the clinic, there's plenty of alternatives for protests for everything else. Maybe Marshall kick in?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's probably that's sort of the argument we're making about this island of intel, where they are trying to take over what used to be sort of public functions and claim their private authority over them.
Yeah.
And I think that the more we're willing to do that, or sort of use these somewhat antithetic to the public and private to determine people's rights, the less we're going to see those rights being exerted, only because that we don't know place to exert them anymore.
Yeah. You've been trying to do it for a while. Try the mic. Oh, you forgot what you were trying to say. Okay. Yeah.
I have a hard time seeing why Intel is a whole lot different than eBay in this case.
eBay can be there's edge case, I think.
Especially because there's free email anywhere on the web. Everybody can get free email. It's not like the Intel email is the only email address that these employees have. And the eBay bidder's edge argument is in part based on the fact that if we allow one person to do this, then everybody will be able to do it, and then that would be the burden that actually would show that there was any harm. So I don't see in this case why we wanted to find out these people's addresses offline and email them. We have a whole different story, but we all find off Intel, not Intel email, and email them. We have a whole different story, but I don't know why Intel should be required to use its resources for things that are against its mission.
Yeah, so recall that the eBay Bidder's Edge case, that was where you had the meta site reporting bids from across the internet to different options on stuff that matches short of your search term, that's Bidder's Edge. They have robots that go and gather the prices from eBay so that they can generate those comparative charts. And eBay says, we don't want your robots on our property. That's trespass, because we'd rather people have to come to our site if you are advertising and get stuck within eBay rather than be able to view it at a distance. And you're right that there was a question as to did this trespass of these robots amount to any material burden on their servers? And the answer from the judge appeared to be no, but applying the Kantian categorical imperative, what if everybody started doing it? And presumably the what if everybody started doing it argument could apply to Ken, so even though he's not harming anything, even with just one email, if everyone did it, why that potentially burden the server? And that rings true to you.
Yeah. I think for me, it seems to me you can make the same argument, especially given the fact that as an eBay Bidder's Edge can go in, I think the judge said that Bidder's Edge can go in and manually search the site, so there's an alternative way. And then with Hamidi, you could, all these people probably have email addresses outside of it, but also you can theoretically go find them.
Yeah. Now, the eBay beginner's edge case is quite interesting because there are, in the public policy reasons we're thinking of, if we're feeling sympathetic, say, to Canadian or even cyber promotions, have to do with free speechy kinds of stuff, the benefit of being able to reach people. And indeed, there may be alternative email addresses, they're free after all for now, for each of the employees at Intel, but it may be quite harder for Ken to reach them if they're anywhere other than Intel.com, as you know where they are, what their names are. Exactly the sort of stealing of the list idea that was maybe one thing that one person here thought might have against Ken is exactly what enables him to do what he's doing with no other alternatives. It's not good that the alternative email addresses gives Ken another avenue to reach these people. But there, at least, in both cyber promotions and the Intel case, we're talking free speech policy stuff. In eBay, there's edge. Maybe, as it's become clearer since webblinding day, there could be other common policy reasons to think that when we uphold the right against trespass or eBay, we can be hurting everybody because it's easier to get blocked in the eBay site then. The ability to shop among sites is cramped, and in turn, it enables price discrimination by the given site because it's just harder to shop and charge you that higher price, which, as we know from that, might be a good thing. Anyway, it's not clear which way public policy shakes out. They do all interrelate as people are trying to pick and choose, once they look up to the internet, what they have to suffer through and what they don't. And also notice here we're talking about an arms race to some. Do I have the right to block, to try to block, and then do they have the right to try to get around me? That's the arms race part of it. Versus, do we want to leave it to the arms race? Let's take it to a court and just get a judgment. Ken, you are not even allowed to try to get around and block. You are prohibited. Trespassing. And it might even be used by the one person who calls this weak comedian, strong, weak intel, and strong intel. The weak intel case would be the holding that Ken is not trespassing when he cleverly thinks about how to get around the defenses and deliver an email to the box of an intel employee. Strong intel would be he has an affirmative right to do so. It's not just it's left to chance whether he can hack around. He may somehow exercise legal process and demand the right to be there. Notice that March doesn't necessarily go that far. March doesn't say that if they were to erect a gate and to prevent anybody without Gulf Shipbuilding Company ID to enter Chickasaw, that she would have a right to barge in to have an order of the court that says she is allowed to enter. Rather, at least the more narrow holding of March, weak March, you may call it, is once she figures out how to get there, she doesn't have to be, she can't be legally removed. You can't invoke the law to get her to leave. Is that distinction making sense? Because now it all starts to fall into place. That distinction has been curated again and again. It's how the trusted systems are right to hack. I get my crack at trying to break your system. Maybe for the purposes of fair use, if I get the data inside, versus copy duty. You have a duty to give me the stuff. It's not just I get fair game, and hopefully I've got a better cryptographer than you do. It's you must give me the stuff. And whether we want the law to intervene as a policy matter and kind of say, this is when you are entitled to the stuff and when you're not, versus the technological arms race part of things. Is an interesting question. Again, it's just, I'm just trying to highlight this one we've seen coming time and again as to what people battle to be able to do with technological arms race and what they ask for to settle as a right.
Yeah. I guess I'm confused. This is going back to, I don't remember your name in the red back there. Going back to Todd's point, which is, so it seems, and maybe I'm taking you in the wrong direction, but it seems that you're saying that therefore, these private, so-called private entities still have this right to create a wall, which one way to read what you're saying is that private entities have a right to create a wall, and if you wind up not being able to get over the wall, tough luck. But I thought one of the points that Ty was making was the boundary between private and public is very fuzzy. You know, what's a gated community instead of public and private? And moreover, if you have an explosion of these private communities, then what's left of the public? So that if you allow these private communities to create their little walls, then there is no public. In which case, isn't there then an affirmative right on the part of this quip. I don't know, I guess the free speech right is the right to listen, but isn't there some affirmative right on the part of the speaker to go in through that, to bust through that wall, in order to, for them to be adorned on the wall?
We don't know. Marsh seems to leave that for another day. Marsh, after all, was not Marsh v. Alabama. It's Marsh v. Alabama. It's not Marsh plaintiff versus Alabama defendant. It's just she was the appellant. She was defending against the trespass action. We don't know if they built a moat and a castle wall around Chickasaw. If she, as the plaintiff, Marsh v. Alabama, strong Marsh, would have a right to get in. We had very few questions to see if there were any cases somehow establish that right, either rephrase it, but people building there, a right of the person to enter, or a duty of the person inside to allow in. Aaron?
Well, I was going to look for the decision, but I was pretty sure the decision actually did address that point, and I thought that the decision suggested that because they were not excluding, this looked like any other town specifically because they were not excluding anybody up until they decided to exclude this panel here, and that went partly to the justice decision. And they should treat this like any other town.
Which suggests that if they had built the castle of the moat,
that they would have
she would more lose. Like
property, right, then.
Right. And it might even suggest then that she would not only lose in an attempt to get the court to force her in, to help her in, but she might even be losing if she managed to get in and was asked to leave, so long as they had gone to trouble building a game.
That was my reading of the case. I'll look at the text to see if I
can. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, we have a number of gated communities now. Company town is kind of making a comeback precisely because people like to live in the riverbank. And I don't yet know of any cases on record about the rights to, you know, protest in the middle of the hearing. Yeah.
Just one interesting analogy that that Marianne Kessel lived to be, and I ended up being on the same line, so it was credit here too, was on the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, figuring when would this likely come up, union notation. And there's a case decided September 21st of this year by the NLRB that addresses a related issue in the TF email. They say, should employees be allowed to use their own TV and their own VCR in the break room at the employer site to broadcast union pro-union messages during a unionization drive? And they said yes, and they recognized kind of correlation, said this may have applications for email, faxes, other communications. We set that aside for now, but they see other differences. So it seems like we may be moving in the direction where, you know, what some of our colleagues have said, you know, it's not as clear that there's an absolute privacy, absolute private property right in employees' work spaces.
Yeah, it's also an amazing reminder that while we're at kind of 50,000 feet trying to reconstruct all the constitutional law documents through the internet, you know, the NLRB is dutifully chugging along, giving the employee-owned VCRs brought into break rooms 6 inches or more from the water cooler, and whether that constitutes allowable activity under the Byzantine labor laws. Yeah, Brad.
Just a simple question. Can a firm or a company decide not to forward regular incoming mail to its employees? Can it just say, well, we don't accept private mailings here, and this doesn't look like it belongs to us, so we're not going to pass it on to you?
I don't know. Yeah?
I think a harder question even is, can they decide selectively? I think it's one thing if they said, we don't take anything, like any, or it's only saying, running grab and saying, you know, company could say to you, no email on work time, or no personal phone calls, period, on work time. What happens if they say, only ones we don't like, or you can't call your grandma, but you can call anybody else? Does that make any difference?
Because so US mail delivers to an address and goes to the shipping and receiving, but there's basically a company censor appointed to get rid of mail likely to waste employees' time or offend them or otherwise not be helpful to the company. I don't know. What cause of action would there be interfering with the US mail? I don't know.
I mean, maybe in the mail case, yeah, you have a problem. But it just seems like there's the policy issues that Sean said, we want to work at a company, not fascist. But it's still
how
like, how would you know is the other problem, especially the email. That's kind of what bothered me about the real-time black hole list from yesterday, which is, I guess in their case they often tell you your email didn't get there, but the fact that sometimes you don't even know it doesn't get there, you just send it out actually into this black hole and never know.
Yeah.
So it seems like that's what a real-time black hole looks like.
So let's see, there's a real-time black hole. So again, given most of us are feeling quite sympathetic as Ken. There's a real-time black hole that's fall victim to a harsh analysis that says essentially they are conspiring with some of the other middle people, the other private operators of the road that is the information superhighway about email articles, that they're stopping Mrs. Marsh maybe from doing what she does. At least they have to win a First Amendment case. Does that mean that Paul Bixie has First Amendment responsibilities?
If you can get around the state action problem, yeah. That's the part I can figure out.
So let me just give a quick opinion on that, because I actually think we'll explain that problem. So I told him as much, but without even realizing. I don't think that Marshall, Alabama is really a case about state action. Now that's a somewhat heretical thing to say, because if you heard anything about Marshall, Alabama and Conlon, what you heard was it was a case about state action, a case about when a company, town, a private party becomes a state actor because they've taken on so many features of a public entity. I say that that's not what Marsh v. Alabama was about. Because after all, the facts of Marsh v. Alabama, it was an Alabama police officer that escorted her out, and it's Alabama criminal law being brought to bear, and you bet there's state action. State action all over the place. There's no question of state action. You look at it, you don't see them deliberating about that. Rather, it's a question of when does trespass, when do the circumstances surrounding a trespass, an alleged trespass, take on a certain feature such that the state action involved in vindicating the trespass law actually amounts to a viable First Amendment complaint? This may sound like a very subtle point, but I don't think it is. I think there is a First Amendment test that they need, even CompuServe, in its invoking a law has to pass, and Marsh gives us a guidepost as to just how serious the test is, whether you're going to flunk it or not. But I don't think state action is actually going to be a bar to hearing it, because after all, you've got a court order. I mean, that's the state acting. So, yeah.
Doesn't that just get back to what you're saying about the police who are supporting people out of their house?
Under this theory, if you get hit with a criminal trespass action for having been in somebody's house, if you raise a First Amendment claim, I'm not sure state action is the way to swat it down. It depends. If you raise a claim against the basis by which the owner of the house ordered you out, all right, well maybe that's a private party. But it was about the way the police handled what you did, you bet that's state action. And again, it's likely to lose. Generally applicable law, time, place, and manner, you know, there's all sorts of ways to get it out of the strict scrutiny box. But I don't think it avoids it entirely. Again, this is somewhat of a contrarian view, let me just be clear. It's not accepted orthodoxy. Although it's not clear to me that anything is here because the stuff hasn't been studied to death yet. Let me try to piece some of this stuff together with some helpful slides going just in the direction they've been going. Here is MapQuest's map of the city of Cambridge. Let's see if I can do something other than plunge us completely into darkness. All right, so here's MapQuest's map of the city of Cambridge. Now, what is notable about this to me is that the yellow spaces represent more or less private property, and the gray lines are roads. So what do we take if we're coming from Mars? We see this, we see that there are not a whole lot of patches of yellow that don't have this lattice work of roads, like capillaries coming off the arteries, feeding, bringing blood to the different sections, the individual cells of private space. And it may be that the best way to understand trespass law, escaping the state action, no state action, doctrinal argument, or does the email signal actually constitute a trespass, is to see that at least here, part of the reason we can vindicate a private actor's right to kick you off her property is that they can't punch you very far.
Trump can do, whether with the help of the police or just on their own, a big burly guard escorts you to the edge. The edge is never far from where you meant to be. And where you meant to be is small enough that people, the law firm example notwithstanding, often have to enter and exit to go there. So we can understand then the vindication of the private right to enjoy peace and quiet in your house without having to worry about Jehovah's Witnesses on your couch as walking hand in hand, only really making sense, being fully cognizable when you see the other half of the equation, which is the latticework of gray to which the Jehovah's Witness may retreat, for which all sorts of protections suddenly kick in. And there are a few places for which that latticework is there as a net to save the surly protester from being kicked too far. Now, if we look at the town of Chickasaw on that quest, here it is, it still exists today. And you can see it happened in the name by corporation. Pine Street, Oak Street, Hill Street, all connected to Viaduct Road. And in the middle, Gulf Street, which was the Gulf Shipbuilding Company, after all. So here, much thicker pieces of private tract. The capillaries themselves are private, after all, it's a company town. And it's only Route 43 here, it's the state highway. So Mrs. Marsh gets punted, she gets punted all the way across the railroad tracks and onto Route 43 if she wants to distribute her message to the citizens of Chickasaw. To me, it might be the right message, the enduring message to take from Marsh, is that that's too far to punt. That what we wanted was this interplay of public and private that we've come to expect as a matter of course in the world around us. And that when that interplay is so off kilter in this very unusual situation, the Supreme Court can actually step in, whether it's the weak form or the strong form, we're not sure. But we have some license to step in and say, guess what? These capillaries have got to bring the one of debate for the rest of themselves here. That is a much richer, at least, whether accurate or not, I think, to you, a much richer interpretation of Marsh v. Alabama than some nuanced point about state action. So now let's see how this applies to the internet, what we've been learning about the net, right? Here is my highly graphical rendition of the city of Cambridge on a typical street. Each of the yellow blocks representing private tracts owned by owners, represented by officials, and the city right down the middle. And anybody tosses you out, boom, you can go right next adjacent because of the city. Chickasaw is an easy case, in a sense, because it so neatly just fit into the same analysis. It's just instead of the city, you have the Gulf Shipbuilding Company in the middle. And if the Gulf Shipbuilding Company had wanted to prevent Mrs. Marsh from being here, that looked too much like the city for that to be permitted. Indeed, it's not even clear that they would have been permitted for, they would have been allowed to prevent her from just walking through. If for some reason the only way to get over here, which we presume is public land, and up there is public land, the only way to get easily from one to the other is to walk down Main Street, we might hypothesize that she would have a right to do it. Now we're starting to get into easements and things like this, but certainly the easement would be very sympathetic if it's already a street generally held open to the public. You're not allowed to discriminate even as a private street owner. Even if somebody wanted an easement on your lawn, it's not clear that you can start choosing who gets to walk over your territory to the beach and who doesn't, once it has become sort of part of the public's right of way. So now let's just see how does the internet fit in. Presume that these are individual servers. Now, if J is Intel's server, we're trying to figure out whether Ken has the right to send an email from D, presume that's his server, all the way up to the cloud, right? We've got the internet cloud in the middle. And then it's on to J, and J is trying to keep them out. Now this is a much harder case because there's no next to. What does it mean to say that Ken's message can hang out right at the D? And we can vindicate the right of the J to be pure of it, but we want Ken nearby. That's a lot harder to think of in cyber topology. Because on one hand, everything is just one click away. Faceintel.com is one click away from intel.com. On the other hand, how would you possibly know to go there? It might as well be the protest march miles away from the clinic you're trying to protest, even though topologically it's about a click. This is a really hard problem. If we think about the real-time black hole list in this diagram, the real-time black hole list is a way to let the private parties that comprise the cloud, the internet service providers, the backbone, anybody possessing a router that allows viewing, any of these private parties would be in a position to stop, to start dropping packets. That's what we came to yesterday at the end with the idea of packet-level black holing, which appeared to be news to the lawyer. You may hear about it soon if there's a complaint filed about it. But that is, in effect, these guys able to act in concert to let some speech through and some speech not. And Marsh v. Alabama may well be a telling case. If I wanted to shut down the real-time black hole list, or I wanted to demand of it some kind of due process, administrative law, all the stuff we're used to when the water department comes to shut off our water for non-payment, where we get 6 years of litigation and form filing before they actually get to get rid of the water. To demand that at all, the first step would be to show how this chart might relate to Marsh v. Alabama and the idea that on the internet, we don't have public capillaries. We have private capillaries that look a lot like them, and which historically, if we can speak of 3 or 2 years of being historical, have been essentially neutral in their treatment of the traffic on. And now we start, sadly, as we end, to see how the larger arguments about end-to-end networking fit in. And those were some optional readings. I'm going to end up either starting next session, getting a little bit into our topic for that, or saving for our grand summation on December 6th, the way in which the end-to-end argument is a larger genus for which Black Hole List, the Intel Media case, and others, including cyber explosions, are the species that illustrate this tension between the public and the private, and the idea that whatever you think about the merits of each of these cases, this encoded cloud in the middle is starting to take shape. The idea that every packet is treated roughly equally, and that those in the middle remain and on its route, take no interest in and have no power over what rate it takes as it goes, or whether or not it shall pass at all. These are questions now, which I think there are about to be different answers. The pleasant internet cloud in the middle is going away, and that's one of the ways in which all of the debates we've had in class so far, I guess, fit in. So is there anything, any other things, or any other announcements, or anything?
The readings for the classes on Monday are now available online, and the optional registry question will be granted, so remember it if you are interested.
Yeah, Monday's class is Stephen Clark and Eric Huffman reading the class on comparative international cyber law. Tuesday is a visit from Don's Lodge, Networks, and Luke Sebeck. No, Tuesday is from Charlie Jones. Digital content, and then Chuck Sims is coming. And gosh, we've got all sorts of surprises. So have a wonderful Thanksgiving, safe travels, good vacation if you're not celebrating Thanksgiving, and we'll see you next week. And good luck on the papers.